Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. At this juncture in the Biden administration, there is arguably more going on the national and world levels that require presidential leadership than most U.S. presidents experience in an entire term. What with the pandemic, climate change, housing crises, and U.S. political upheaval and division, and calls for sweeping legal and legislative and social reforms, and of course Afghanistan. And Afghanistan may seem like more of a historic milestone, the final actual withdrawal of U.S. troops from the U.S. Occupying force there. Afghanistan is now a free and independent nation again for the first time since the U.S.-engineered coup in the late 1970s that brought down a social reformist administration at that time. Although free may be a relative term, as the liberating regime is in fact a brutal theocratic extremist outfit, but aside from the occasional death or wounding of a U.S. soldier, the psychological impacts on U.S. veterans of the Afghan occupation, and the trauma and suffering of Afghans in the U.S., the greatest impacts of that war here in the U.S. have been the economic ones. Enormous amounts of capital were spent on that war, while vital social programs at home were deprived. We're used to that, of course, as the U.S. has usually been involved in a foreign war somewhere, and the percentage of federal expenditures devoted to all aspects of military spending is one of the highest in the world by far. But we're also used to crumbling infrastructure at home, and underfunded schools, and aged water lines leaching lead, inadequate power grids failing in storms and heat waves and cold snaps, all of which are getting more frequent and worse due to climate change. Just the other day, I was driving on West 5th under the railroad overpass, where the concrete is crumbling and you can see the rusty rebar armature inside of the buttresses, and I noticed that a fresh chunk of that concrete had fallen. At the same time, our social needs have been growing, and we're increasingly unfulfilled. Affordable housing is an urgent crisis made worse by the pandemic, as renters who have been unable to pay their landlords will soon face eviction, and those landlords are feeling pressure from developers who want to snatch up urban and suburban properties and build their lookalike luxury condoplexes, meaning that once affordable, locally owned properties will disappear and be replaced with expensive corporate-owned facilities, transforming both the physical and the social landscape permanently. There are shortages of teachers and nurses and lower numbers of those people seeking to enter those professions, and we're seeing closures of rural hospitals and even some schools. For these reasons, progressive politicians have been calling for sweeping social reforms. Some have called for universal health care, others for free college tuition. Some are calling for housing reform, and others for more funding for education and for policing reform and renewable energy and mass transit. All of these proposals are genuinely popular, but nothing ever seems to actually get done, as Democratic administrations drag their feet and compromise and equivocate, while Republicans slash at the remaining remnants of the existing social safety net and gut environmental protections and workplace safety rules. The perception of the net gain being virtually nil over time has eroded public confidence in government overall. But thanks in part to two campaigns by Bernie Sanders, who served as a galvanizing focal point for the progressive movement overall, and also to the Black Lives Matter movement and the current iteration of the women's movement, etc., President Biden was elected with more of a progressive mandate than any president in U.S. history, I would argue. Though the Democrats' majority in the House is slim and the Senate is evenly divided, the Biden administration has put forth one of the boldest and transformative packages of reforms and initiatives in modern U.S. history, in a pair of infrastructure bills now making their way through the legislature. These have been resisted by Republicans and even one or two right-wing Democrats, those being Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. The initial huge infrastructure proposal, championed by Sanders and others, was split into two bills, the first dealing with physical infrastructure. The smaller $1.2 trillion package has passed the Senate now, and a version of it is likely to pass the House or has passed the House. It will be modified. A second $3.5 trillion package deals with more with climate change, housing, education, urban planning and renewal, healthcare, etc., collectively being referred to as human infrastructure. That bill, which has yet to be finalized, is likely to get zero Republican votes in the Senate, but could pass in the Senate through the budget reconciliation process if Manchin and Sinema would get on board. We're close, it seems, to seeing the equivalent of a New Deal in an era of massive social investment and revitalization, tinged with a sense of justice and equanimity, and yet we also seem so far from that dream, thanks to Sinema and Manchin and their Republican allies. It's a bit baffling and even difficult to follow and understand given the density of details and the complexity of the process. So in today's show, we'll hear several presentations and reports that I hope will put it into perspective. We'll start with an excerpt from a PBS NewsHour report from last week talking about where the two bills stand at the moment.
While here in Washington, President Biden's push for a sweeping infrastructure bill has taken a giant step forward today. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor begins with that story.
Come on. At the White House, a rare presidential appearance in the driveway to announce a big bipartisan deal.
We had a really good meeting, and to answer your direct question, we have a deal.
The agreement came after President Biden and a bipartisan group of senators settled on a framework for an infrastructure bill in a compromise that both sides are praising.
I'm pleased to see today we were able to come together on a core infrastructure package. This is not non-infrastructure items, without new taxes, and with the commitment from Republicans and Democrats alike that we're going to get this across the finish line.
No one got everything they wanted in this package. We all gave some to get some, because what we did was put first the needs of our country.
The total price tag of the package is $1.2 trillion over 8 years. Over 5 years, it's $973 billion. Overall, there's $579 billion in new spending. As Republicans wanted, it focuses more on traditional items like roads, bridges, broadband, and the power grid, among other areas. So the scope of this deal is much narrower than President Biden's initial $2.2 trillion proposal. But President Biden insists Democrats will pass a separate deal with their infrastructure priorities aimed at families and communities.
But if only one comes to me, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem.
The framework does not include money for so-called human infrastructure that many Democrats want, from child care to climate change to anti-poverty efforts. Progressives, led by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, are demanding that those items be addressed simultaneously in a separate bill. It would advance through a budget process known as reconciliation that requires only a simple majority in the 50-50 Senate. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
I think it is way too small, paltry, pitiful, and I will insist on a second package that not only addresses more roads, bridges, and other tangible assets, but also human infrastructure.
On the House side, Speaker Nancy Pelosi was equally blunt.
There ain't going to be an infrastructure bill unless we have the reconciliation bill passed by the United States Senate.
Late today on the Senate floor, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said he was encouraged by the day's progress, but he criticized Democrats and President Biden for insisting that the bipartisan deal be passed along with a Democrat-backed reconciliation bill.
Less than 2 hours after publicly commending our colleagues and actually endorsing the bipartisan agreement, the president took the extraordinary step of threatening to veto it.
But a real assessment of whether it can get the 60 votes to pass is unlikely until after the Senate returns from a 2-week recess that begins tomorrow.
And Yamiche joins us now from the White House, along with Lisa Desjardins at the Capitol. And Lisa, to you first. We know senators who were part of this have spent many weeks trying to come up with this deal. Give us some of the details of what exactly is in here.
Judy, this is a huge moment. Now, this bill does have a long road ahead. This hasn't crossed the finish line yet. But this is a very big victory for bipartisanship in an age of divide. And also, this would be, if it goes through, the largest single transportation bill in American history. So let's talk about what's in it really quickly. A lot. At the top, some of the biggest categories. Roads and bridges, over $100 billion for those. Another $100 billion plus for rails and public transportation. Now, there is also in this bill a number of categories on climate. And it depends on how you add up the math, but it's between $15 billion and $60 billion. That's everything from electric vehicle charging stations to mitigations for our coastlines, dealing with ecosystems, addressing the effects already of climate change. And then finally, one thing I want to highlight, $55 billion for clean water and pipes. That's for things like changing out lead pipes that are still in so many parts of America. Judy, I could go on and on. This bill has a lot of money for the power grid, for airports, for our ports at sea, for ferries, for broadband. It is a massive bill.
And Lisa, as you and others are pointing out, it is not as much as the president originally wanted, but there's still a lot of money in here. How are they going to pay for it?
This was the toughest part of reaching this point in the deal. And I have to tell you, we just got the official release from senators laying out how they pay for it. Judy, there are no dollar figures next to the categories. Fortunately, I was able to get a copy of what the dollar figures were from a senator who saw that. And some of the biggest pay-fors are things like taking unspent COVID money and using that, also changing how the IRS operates, helping boost the IRS so it could collect more taxes, enforce basically the law on tax cheats. I think overall, Lisa Murkowski put it well, it's a smorgasbord of pay-fors. There are no tax increases in this. This is what Republicans wanted. But when you do that, that means that there are a lot of things in here that are in the gray area, kind of questionable math that I think we'll be looking at for a long time to come. I want to just give a sense quickly of the scope of this bill. This is really what brought everybody together. If you look at the most recent large transportation bills, the last three, for example, if you see, look at the one today. It is almost twice as much as the biggest bills previous to this. How did this come together? One last anecdote. I'm told by senators in the room, Judy, that yesterday things were so tense, this almost fell completely apart. Senator John Tester of Montana went in the room, put his hands down, and said, "Guys, we have to get this big boy done." And then everyone sort of took a breath and did find a way to get it across this initial finish line.
Interesting about Senator Tester's role, Senator Tester of Montana. So, Yamiche, we heard a lot from President Biden on the campaign trail when he was running for president. He wanted infrastructure passed. Tell us more about his role in getting to where we are today and where this goes from here.
Well, this bipartisan infrastructure bill, this huge bill, it's like President Biden catching his white whale. He had said over and over again on the campaign trail that he was going to be for bipartisanship, that he was going to be working across the aisle. And now you have this mood here at the White House today of real jubilance, of feeling like here is President Biden proving people wrong. And that's why we saw the president do a couple rare things today. Just a few feet away from me is the White House driveway. We never see the president come up to the microphones that are usually stationed there. But this time, the president swaggered up with Republicans and Democratic senators and it announced that there was a deal. You could see the happiness in his face. And then, of course, he held that impromptu press conference explaining how they got to this deal, explaining all of the different things that were in it. Now, I've been talking to White House sources and they underscore that this bill they think is transformational. And to put it into even more context here, in 1956, under President Eisenhower, the interstate highway system was constructed. And in today's dollars, that would be over $500 billion. This bill tops that. So that is what the White House is wanting to underscore here today. And when it comes to the president's role, he was very, very engaged. The president, before he left for Europe, for NATO and G7, he underscored that he wanted to get a deal done. When I came back, I talked to White House officials immediately, and they said that their prospect was better than when the president left. And that tells you that the White House was on Capitol Hill doing this work, ironing out these numbers in the details.
And finally, Yamiche, is there an early sense there at the White House of what this could mean for the rest of the president's agenda?
Well, that is the big question. It's the question that I put to the president today when he held that impromptu press conference at the White House in the East Room. And I asked the president, what does this mean for voting rights or for police reform? What have you learned in working with Republicans that informs the way forward? And he told me that this really is about the idea that he wants to try to push forward with all of his different agenda items. But he also said that he was focused in some ways really on voting rights. He said he made some news today saying that he's going to be touring the country on voting rights. When I talk to White House officials, though, they say caution when it comes to whether or not other bipartisanship will come through this. But when you look at this deal, we have to remind people that the timing here is still in flux. There was some talk of it being in September or possibly in the fall. So there's a real question about how the president is going to get Democrats on that reconciliation bill. So even as the president is thinking about what's next, we have to underscore that Democrats still have some work to do on really getting this two-track system all the way through. But bipartisanship lives today, Judy, and that is something that is rare to say here.
A head-turning day at the White House. Yamiche Alcindor, Lisa Desjardins, we thank you both.
You're welcome.
Next, we have several discussions from various media outlets on the details of the infrastructure plans. Bear in mind that the physical infrastructure plan has bipartisan support enough to pass, but progressives in the House are pledging not to vote for it unless the Senate also passes a human infrastructure proposal as well. They feel that the first package, if it passes alone, may kill the chances for the climate change provisions and health care and other vitally important measures of passing soon or at all. They want to see both bills advance together. Likewise, conservative Democrats have pledged not to support the physical infrastructure bill if the human infrastructure bill component is pushed through the Senate through the budget reconciliation process. Of course, in order to pay for these massive spending plans, revenue would have to be raised. Progressives have proposed, and President Biden agrees, to increase corporate taxes, and not even by very much, and to close some loopholes that companies like Amazon exploit to avoid paying much taxes at all.
Hey, everybody. Scott Dyring here. Happy to be with you today on Fuqua's Wednesday at 12:30 LinkedIn Live sessions. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the proposals, some of the proposals that the Biden administration has made relating to tax changes. The first proposal that the Biden administration has made, it relates to raising the corporate rate, the statutory tax rate for corporations from 21% to 28%. So you might recall that for many years, the corporate tax rate was 35%. If you go way back to the last major tax reform we had in 1986, the corporate tax rate was set at 34%, and it stayed at 34% until the Clinton administration, at which time it was raised to 35%. And from 35%, it stayed constant until the end of 2017, when the Trump tax reforms, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, lowered the rate to 21%. And one of the major campaign promises in the presidential cycle, the election, was that the Biden administration would seek to raise that rate from 21% to 28%. So in thinking about effective tax rates, statutory tax rates, we should also think about effective tax rates, because the rate that a company pays is not necessarily the rate that is on the books as the law. And if you have followed the news, you often see articles about companies that make and report high profits, but also pay very little in tax. In 2016, the year before the Trump Tax Act, the average U.S. company had an effective tax rate of about 26%. The effective tax rate being the amount of cash taxes that the company paid divided by the amount of pre-tax accounting earnings the company reported to shareholders. When the tax rate was reduced from 35% to 21%, that effective rate dropped from 26% in 2016 to about 22% in 2019, which is the most recent year that we have complete data on. The preliminary data for 2020 suggests that the rate will be probably about the same, around 22 or 23%. If the rate were raised from 21% to 28%, a few things would likely happen. The first thing is effective rates would likely increase. So companies would, instead of reporting, say, a 22% effective rate, it's likely that that rate would go up. Would it go up all the way to 28%? Probably not. Companies rarely pay exactly the statutory tax rate, and on average, they will find ways to reduce their income for tax purposes, and will probably pay a rate lower than 28% if that is the statutory tax rate. Nevertheless, raising the rate will likely raise some revenue, and if the objective of the administration is to raise more revenue from companies, from corporations, then raising the rate to 28% would accomplish that goal. What are the trade-offs? If the government raises the rate to 28% or something higher, or whatever it is, the higher the rate goes, the greater the incentives for companies to engage in strategic tax avoidance activities. Those activities often involve transferring intellectual property to tax haven countries like Cayman Islands or the Virgin Islands or Ireland or others. And those strategic tax avoidance activities can have distortionary effects on investment, on research, on employment, and other things. And so we always face a trade-off whenever we tax a company. Every tax creates some kinds of economic distortions, and those distortions reduce good things that companies do. My suspicion is raising the rate to 28% will increase some of those distortions, but probably not to an extraordinary level. The other thing that we should think about a little bit with a higher rate is that companies historically have engaged in something known as inversions. And an inversion is where a company changes its location, its legal incorporation location from the United States to a foreign country. It does this essentially to avoid paying tax in the United States in a way that it would if it were an American company. Sometimes these inversions are called expatriations or other names. When the U.S. rate is at 21% and essentially equal to or maybe even slightly lower than other developed countries, U.S. firms have very little incentive to try to relocate to other countries. But when the rate is higher than other developed countries, U.S. firms might have an incentive to relocate, and new firms from entrepreneurial activity might be tempted to form at inception in locations outside the United States. So those are a few things that one might consider when thinking about raising the rate from 21% to 28%. As we go along, feel free to ask any questions related to rates, and I'm happy to give my opinion. The next issue that the Biden administration is considering is to implement what they are terming a minimum global tax. One of the issues that has been prominent in the press related to tax avoidance is that large U.S. multinational companies, and particularly those companies with heavy intellectual property presence, can move that intellectual property to really any location in the world. And as a result, much of that intellectual property is located in foreign jurisdictions with low tax rates. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to tax those companies with a lot of intellectual property. The Trump administration recognized in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that when the rate was lowered there and the system was changed in the way that it was changed with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, companies might increase the amount of earnings recorded in low tax foreign countries. And so a new tax rule was created that goes by the acronym GILTI, G-I-L-T-I, which stands for Global Intangible Low Tax Income, GILTI. And GILTI income is foreign earnings earned in a foreign country that the U.S. taxes. And the U.S. tax rate on those foreign earnings is sort of low. It's like 11%. So companies still have an incentive to recognize earnings in foreign countries because 11% is lower than 21%. The Biden administration is proposing a change, several significant changes to the GILTI tax regime. The first change is that they want to raise the rate on GILTI income from essentially 11 or 12% up to about 21%. That's a pretty big change, and it would certainly cause many companies to pay more U.S. tax on their foreign earnings. The second change is that under the current GILTI rules, a company does not have to pay tax on GILTI income for any income that is earned below 10% return on foreign assets. So in other words, you only pay GILTI tax on earnings where the return on assets is quite high. The Biden proposal would remove that exemption for earnings below the 10% return on assets threshold. And the third change is that this GILTI tax would be calculated on a country-by-country basis as opposed to pooling across countries the different earnings and losses and so forth. This last measure could be quite, I would say, substantial in terms of changing the tax on foreign earnings, because it could result in situations where multinational companies end up paying taxes to the U.S., even though overall abroad their consolidated earnings are low or even negative. So this will be a significant change. If this change happens, it could require the cooperation of other countries and to make it work well. And Janet Yellen has signaled a willingness to cooperate with other countries. And to the extent that that happens, this could be a really meaningful change in the way companies are taxed on their global income, U.S. companies taxed on their global income. The third major area of reform is related to what I would has been termed a 15% minimum tax on financial accounting income. Now, this is essentially a rule which is being proposed in response to several high-profile situations where well-known companies reported very large profits to shareholders in their financial reports, but paid little or no tax to the federal government. Maybe the most famous example is, I think 2 years ago, Amazon reported $11 billion in pre-tax income and paid no federal tax. More recently, we've seen companies like, for example, Salesforce reported $2.6 billion of U.S. income and paid no federal income tax. And there was a recent article about Zoom, the company that we have all grown to love or hate, also recording significant profits and paying very little federal tax. What this proposal is designed to do is to prevent any company that records large financial accounting profits from paying no tax. This is almost unambiguously, from an accounting point of view, and I am an accountant, this is a bad idea. And the reason that this idea is a bad idea is let me explain to you, I guess I should say, why this is a bad idea. The tax system is created to achieve several different purposes. One of those purposes is to raise revenue. Another purpose is to encourage or discourage certain types of behavior. So, for example, we might impose a tax on cigarettes because we think that smoking is bad for your health. Or we might provide a tax credit for a firm that invests in renewable energies. And those types of provisions are designed to encourage behavior, not to raise revenue. A third reason that we, or objective of the tax code, is that we often attempt to achieve social objectives, such as redistribution of income or wealth. In contrast, the financial accounting rules under generally accepted accounting principles in the United States have an entirely different purpose. The purpose is generally to provide information to investors to aid them in the efficient allocation of their scarce resources, to provide an economic picture of the company, and to guide those types of investment decisions. You can imagine if taxes are suddenly imposed on financial accounting earnings, that a couple of things could quickly arise. First, companies might be tempted to alter the way that they account for earnings to reduce their tax bills. This might have an unintended side effect of reducing the value of the information in those reports that will make them less reliable to investors. The second and more concerning issue is that if the tax revenue is suddenly tied to financial accounting income, it will be very difficult for our elected leaders who set tax policy to constrain themselves from also trying to meddle in financial accounting rules. And in fact, a few years ago during, I guess a year and a half ago or so during the presidential cycle, in the campaigns, Senator Warren, who was running for president, made a proposal similar to this one that the Biden administration has now proposed. And I wrote an op-ed, which is published in the Wall Street Journal, essentially opposing this proposal on the grounds that financial accounting information could become subjected to the desires of politicians. Shortly after, several months later, a letter was written to the Financial Accounting Standards Board by Elizabeth Warren and several other senators requesting that a certain financial accounting standard be adopted to aid in tax enforcement. This is exactly the type of thing we don't want our politicians doing. We need financial accounting rules to be apolitical. And taxing financial accounting earnings will almost immediately create a situation where financial accounting becomes another political tool. So for many reasons, taxing financial accounting earnings is probably not a great idea. And one of those reasons is trying to keep the politicians from politicizing financial accounting rules. I have a question that's come in that asks whether large earnings are untaxed because of previous year losses, and whether or not it makes sense to then use financial accounting earnings. So in other words, how could Amazon possibly earn $11 billion and pay zero tax? That's a really good question. And actually, there's a very simple explanation. And this explanation is true for Amazon. It's also true for Salesforce. And it's also true for Zoom. Amazon in 2018 recorded $11.4 billion, if I recall correctly, in profits. Amazon and many other tech firms, they pay their employees, at least in part, using share-based compensation. And in the case of Amazon, it's restricted stock units. When an employee is hired at Amazon, Amazon might grant to an employee a restricted share. And when that share is granted, the financial accounting rules require that Amazon record a compensation expense in its financial reports based on the fair value of the restricted stock unit, which is the price of the share on the date that it was granted. So if Amazon's stock price 5 years ago was, say, for example, in fact, I think I looked this up. I think 5 years ago, Amazon's price was $620 per share. If a company was hired 5 years ago by Amazon, Amazon would give a restricted unit and record a compensation expense of $620. The IRS, however, does not allow Amazon to take a compensation tax deduction because the employee doesn't yet control that share. And in fact, the employee might leave and never control the share. And so Amazon would never even really give the share before it vests. And it would not make sense to give a deduction for something that hasn't yet been realized. Instead, what the IRS says is when the restricted stock unit vests and the employee then has control of it, then Amazon can take a deduction for that share that is given away, and the deduction will be equal to the fair value of that share on the date of vesting. And this makes sense because the employee will pay tax on personal income tax on the value of the share that is received on the date of vesting. In Amazon's case, suppose the share vested 5 years after it was given. So it was given at a price of $620, but 5 years later, today, when it vests, Amazon's price is $3,308. The employee would have to pay tax on the $3,308, just like they had been paid in cash. And Amazon will receive a deduction for $3,308, just like they had paid the employee in cash. Everything seems fine there. But what's interesting is financial accounting does not require an additional compensation expense because the share price increased. As a result, when Amazon reports its income, it does not record the difference of $2,800 in compensation expense on the financial statements, which makes it look like it has really high financial accounting income. But for tax purposes, it gets a really big deduction. So when all the dust settled for Amazon, it had 11.2 billion of restricted stock units that vested, and it had 11.4 billion of income. And that meant that its deductions essentially offset all of its income, and it didn't pay any tax.
Welcome to our InFocus discussion tonight on the Human Infrastructure Bill. It's a proposed $3.5 trillion budget resolution framework that would fund items like child tax care credits, paid family and medical leave, affordable housing, expanding Medicare, and ensuring a pathway to citizenship. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont joined us earlier via Zoom from Washington, D.C. to share why he supports the bill.
Senator, thank you so much for being here. Why should people in Utah care about the Human Infrastructure Bill? How would it impact them?
Well, it'll impact Utah, Vermont, and every other state in the country in the sense that for decades now, Rosie, while the very richest people in this country have become much richer, working families in the middle class have struggled. And what many of us believe is now is the time to develop policy that works for ordinary Americans and not just wealthy campaign contributors. So this is a little bit of what it will do. It says that if you are a working class person with children, you'll continue receiving that $300 check, which is so important in terms of enabling working families to be able to raise their children and has helped us already reduce childhood poverty by over 60%. We are going to revolutionize childcare so that no family in America has to pay more than 7% of their income and make pre-K for the 3 and 4 year olds free. We're also going to expand Medicare so that the elderly people in this country can get the dental care, the hearing aids, the eyeglasses that they need. We're going to end the disgrace of the United States being the only major country on earth not to guarantee paid family and medical leave. We're going to greatly improve home health care so that the disabled and the elderly can stay at home rather than be forced to go into a nursing home. And we are going to deal with the existential threat of climate change. And when we do all of those things, we create millions of good-paying jobs, improve life for working families.
A concern brought forth about this bill is its big price tag. How do you justify the cost, and where would we get the money from?
Well, that's a good question. And I think at a time when two people in America own more wealth than the bottom 40%, and the gap between the very, very, very rich, the billionaire class, and everybody else is growing wider, and in some cases, these billionaires and large profitable corporations don't pay a nickel in federal income tax. When the pharmaceutical industry charges us the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, and we're not negotiating prices with them, if we do all of those things, we can raise all the money we need to pay for this piece of legislation.
You have been part of the Senate Budget Committee for years, but now you are the chairman. What have you done and what do you plan to do in this role when it comes to this bill?
Well, I'm the chairman of the Budget Committee. I'm helping to lead the effort in what I believe will be the most consequential and important piece of legislation for working families since FDR, the Great Depression, and the 1930s. For too long, we have turned our backs on the struggles of working families. And you have all over this country, people working longer hours for lower wages. Half our people are living paycheck to paycheck. Now is the time for the United States government to say, hey, we're going to address your needs and not just those of the people on top. So we're working hard on that.
How hopeful are you that it will pass, and what challenges do you anticipate it will face in Congress? Is the timing an issue with the August recess coming up?
We hope right now we are in the middle of a big debate on the bipartisan physical infrastructure bill. I expect that will end in a day or two. And then we will immediately get to a budget resolution, which I believe we will pass without any Republican support. That saddens me, but that's the fact. It would be 50 Democrats plus the Vice President of the United States. Then begins the whole process of reconciliation, exactly what is going to be in the bill. What the budget resolution does is give top lines for various committees. So you have this amount of money, you got to work within that framework. But it's going to be a lot of work to be done over the next month or two. But I hope by early fall, we will have this very important piece of legislation passed.
Senator, we have time for final words. What would you like to leave our viewers with tonight?
I think that there are a lot of people in Vermont, in Utah, all over this country who are giving up on American democracy. They're losing faith that their government is responding to their needs. They see a government dominated by the wealthy and the powerful. And I want to say to those people that some of us, at least, are trying hard to make sure that government addresses the needs of the vast majority of the people and not just wealthy campaign contributors. And that is what this legislation is about. It really will be transformative in improving lives for tens and tens of millions of American middle class and working class people.
Senator, thank you so much for making time for us in Utah. It was great to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Take care, Rosie.
Welcome to our second In Focus discussion on the Human Infrastructure Bill. Earlier, we heard from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on why he supports the $3.5 trillion budget resolution. We turn now to our conversation with Utah Senator Mike Lee on why he opposes the bill.
Senator, thank you for joining us. We'd like to start out our conversation with you with talking about why do you oppose the Human Infrastructure Bill?
We haven't seen the bill yet. It doesn't yet exist. We know based on descriptions made of the bill that it's likely to be the king of all inflation bombs, dropping a massive, massive burden on an already carpet-bombed economy. We know that it's going to spend at least $3.5 trillion. Some estimate that it will actually spend more like $5 trillion. With news trickling in every day, including today, about inflation, we know that when the federal government spends money at this pace, trillions of dollars at a time that it doesn't have and is essentially printing, that really makes it more difficult for everyday Americans to pay for what they need, everything from gasoline to groceries, everything from housing to healthcare. And so I've got grave concerns with this bill, which would add between $3.5 and $5 trillion to our debt.
The bill would be funded by taxing corporations and individuals making more than $400,000 a year. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont said it would essentially help bridge the gap between the wealthy and the working class. What are your thoughts on that methodology of funding?
Well, there again, I haven't seen the bill, so I don't know the details. But I'll tell you this. Look, Bernie Sanders and I actually agree on some things. He and I recently teamed up to introduce the National Security Powers Act. I think he and I strongly disagree when it comes to this bill. And we also strongly disagree with the idea that you can take a massive tax increase and impose that on one end of the economic spectrum and not have it have any effect on other ends of the economic spectrum. If you do that, if you impose this type of tax increase, it's going to end up resulting in people who are poor or hardworking middle-class Americans not being able to have as many job opportunities, not being able to have access to as much economic growth. That will have its own problems.
This bill, from what we know, would focus on a lot of family-centered issues, affordable childcare, universal preschool, as well as other issues such as a pathway to legal citizenship. If you don't think this bill is a good way to address these issues, how else should Congress respond to Americans who are asking for help?
Yeah, well, first of all, those issues are separate and distinct from the budgetary process. Many of those are not themselves budgetary issues. Immigration laws, for example, are within Congress's authority, but they need to be dealt with separately as immigration bills and not through a budgetary loophole that would allow them to do this with a simple majority vote in the Senate. With respect to the other items you mentioned, those may well be worthwhile endeavors in one fashion or another. They're not necessarily matters for government, and they're certainly not matters for the federal government. We do the American people a grave disservice, especially the poor and middle class, when we assume that every problem is a government problem and every government problem is a problem for the federal government.
How do you think this bill is going to do in Congress, and what challenges do you anticipate it will face in Congress?
This bill, if it passes, will pass strictly along party lines. You're not going to see a single Republican in the Senate voting for it. You're not going to see a single Republican in the House voting for it. The closer question in my mind is whether every Democrat in the Senate and every Democrat in the House will vote for it. If they don't, particularly in the Senate, then it won't pass.
Senator, we have time for final words tonight. What would you like to leave our viewers with?
When politicians tell the American people, you need me, very often what the American people should hear is that the politician needs them, not the other way around. When politicians try to gain popularity and praise by spending a whole lot of other people's money, people that the government itself doesn't have, but for the people, it always ought to sound alarm bells. Because when government spends an enormous amount of money, particularly money that the government doesn't have, what that ends up doing is making every dollar that people earn go less far. Look, from one year to the next in our economy, we have roughly the same number of goods, the same basket of goods that can be purchased. When the government just churns out money by the trillions, adding to the debt and deficit each year by the trillions of dollars, it accelerates inflation, meaning there's more money in the economy, but each dollar goes less far. For most Americans who are living in one way or another, paycheck to paycheck, or on a limited budget, as most people are, that means that they're going to be made poorer. Their standard of living is going to go down when the federal government is just printing more money and purporting to benefit all of them. It's really important to remember that, because very often bills like this one will make a small handful of people rich. There are a small handful of other people who are well enough off that they might not feel as much of the pinch. But everyone else, most Americans, will be made poorer as a result of legislation like this.
Senator, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to our third and final In Focus discussion. Now that we've heard both the supporting and opposing arguments on the human infrastructure bill, we turn now to some analysis. Rounding out our conversation tonight in studio is Devin Weiser. He is the executive director of the Olin Walker Institute at Weber State University. And via Zoom is Professor Mark Showalter, who teaches economics at Brigham Young University. Thank you both for joining us tonight. Devin, we will start with you. Can you talk about the process for this bill? Democrats are running it as a budget bill. Can you tell us why they are doing that and what needs to happen for it to pass?
Absolutely. They're running it as a budget bill so they can use the process called budget reconciliation. And that is basically for two reasons. One, it's not subject to the filibuster, so senators can't just talk and delay it forever. And two, it only needs a simple majority to pass. So right now we are an evenly split Senate with 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans. So what they will need to do is retain all 50 Democrats and get the vote of the vice president in order for this to pass. And so that's their goal, and that's what they're going to try and do throughout these next few months.
So it's all strategy,
it sounds like.
Mark, let's turn to you. Can you talk about these types of spending bills? The federal government has passed several spending bills in the past. Do they help the national economy?
Well, we've seen an unusual couple of years. So the amount of spending the federal government has done over the last 2 years is unprecedented. The number Senator Lee mentioned was like $6 trillion over the course of last year. And so in the midst of a once-in-a-lifetime kind of event and with unprecedented collapse of the economy, some of those bills made a lot of sense, and certainly you want to do that to try to stave off complete economic collapse. And so under the circumstances, I think two of the three bills last year actually made tremendous sense, and you have almost complete agreement among professional economists on the value of doing those things in the midst of what was a terrific downturn. Now, we are not in that situation now. We are now, our economy is roaring by all metrics. There's still places we can go, we can still improve, but we're not in an emergency situation. And so consider that we weren't in a good fiscal situation in the federal government before the pandemic. So we were running $1 trillion deficit in 2019, so the year before the pandemic hit, and it was looking worse. So we have less revenues coming in than we have expenditures promised. And so now we're talking about adding to that this enormous bill. And so it makes one wonder a little bit about the wisdom of doing it in such a quick fashion, where we weren't in a good fiscal situation to begin with, and this doesn't look like it's going to help things out, although it's right that we don't have the details on it.
So, Mark, follow-up question for you. What is wrong with deficit spending?
Well, there's nothing in particular wrong. So there are certain situations. So if you think that running a deficit will increase your ability to pay things back in the future, so you invest in infrastructure, for example, or you invest in other kinds of things that are going to produce a return in the future, then your economy grows and you're going to be able to pay those debts back because they're going to have a return to them. And so deficits of themselves aren't a particular problem in a growing economy. And the U.S. has run a deficit for almost all of its history, with a few short exceptions. And we're fine. But what you don't want is having that deficit be growing at a rate faster than you expect the economy to grow. And we are at that point where we've got deficits growing faster than our projections on what we're going to be able to pay back. Now, the difficult part is you don't know when it's going to collapse. You don't know when the lenders are going to say, no, we're not going to lend to you anymore. You spent too much. Greece ran into this problem a few years ago where they needed to take out some more loans, and banks just said, nah, not this time. And it created enormous economic problems. And you just don't know when those emergencies are going to come. And so it's fine to run a deficit you think you can pay back. It's not fine to have a deficit growing at a rate that's vastly different than your underlying economy.
Mark, stay with me here. One concern that Senator Lee brought up was that this bill could cause inflation. And his answer kind of confused some people, especially because the funding is supposed to come from taxing the wealthy. What are your thoughts about this, and how likely is inflation to happen?
Well, inflation is mostly up to what the Federal Reserve decides to do. Now, for the last year, the Federal Reserve has more or less printed money in the way that Senator Lee talked about, where the government would issue debt, and then the Federal Reserve would buy that debt. And so and the way they'd buy it is they print the money and give that to the federal government. They go and spread to give to people in the bank accounts and whatever. And so we talk about that as monetization of the debt. And so that's happened for much of the last year and a half. Now, if the Fed continues to do that, so if we take out $2 trillion worth of debt to pay for this new bill, and the Fed goes and buys all that treasury up, then that's going to be inflationary. If it doesn't, and it's unclear, it's not clear how much is going to be taxes. If it's all taxes and debt that's not purchased by the Fed, then that's not going to be inflationary, meaning that all prices are going to rise at roughly the same rate. The bill will have effects on particular targeted areas. So it's targeting community colleges. That means likely that the tuition at community colleges is going to go up for people who aren't being subsidized. It's targeting daycare, preschool care. Because now there's lots of government money in that, those prices are likely to go up. So it'll be targeted, even if the Federal Reserve doesn't monetize it, but it wouldn't be an inflationary thing that spreads across the whole economy like what we've seen over the last year.
Devin, what are your thoughts on how this bill will be paid for?
So as Senator Lee pointed out, we haven't exactly seen the language yet that will be coming. It's just sort of starting the process. But we anticipate that it will be paid for by raising taxes, particularly in four areas. One, raising taxes on corporations, raising taxes on Americans in a higher tax bracket, raising taxes on capital gains, and raising taxes, raising the what is colloquially known as the death tax, meaning that Americans would be able to, you know, leave less wealth to their children when they die. The reason why the Republicans have an issue with this is because they don't believe that the effects of those tax increases can just be siloed off into that one segment of the population. They think that by passing these tax increases that it will basically leave less money in the pockets of all Americans.
Devin, let's talk about some of the individual parts of this bill. There are a few buckets of funding, and one is for families. Could you discuss the money for pre-K education, paid family sick leave, and the child tax credit?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're looking to have universal pre-K education. So for all children 3 and 4 years old, they would have access to taxpayer-funded or government-funded child care or education, however you want to look at it. In addition, you know, you mentioned a couple other provisions, and there will be many more provisions because, as we've noted before, this is basically the top line. What they're working on this week is the top line ideas for what will be coming through the process. And then what they'll do is they'll, not to get into the procedure too much, but what they'll do is they'll send it out to all of the committees that have jurisdiction, and they'll go and get into the details. And as we all know, the devil's in the details. So we'll see how it all shakes out in the end. And then, you know, Senator Schumer today, he said that they're anticipating a September 15th return. So that's kind of the deadline he's given to the committees. We'll see if they can hold up to that deadline or if they'll have to extend. I imagine these negotiations will be tough because, as I said, they're going to have to keep all 50 Democrats. They can't afford to lose one Democrat.
It's so close. Mark, we have some time for final thoughts. I was hoping to maybe get some of your feelings about the climate change part from an economic perspective. Is there a point where the federal government has to act within a financial component? And what would you like to leave our viewers with tonight?
Well, so on the carbon tax, on the climate issues, that's certainly a major part of the bill. One of the things that is a mantra among economists is if you don't want something, tax it. Okay, you want less of it, tax it. And so the economist's favorite remedy for dealing with climate change, one, you recognize that the private markets aren't going to handle climate change very well because a lot of the things that's emitting pollution, people aren't paying any cost for that. And so when we drive around in a car, we're not paying any attention to the amount we're contributing to global warming. And then when we're warming our house with electricity, we're not worrying about coal-fired plants that are emitting pollutants that are contributing to that as well. And so one of the answers that would help on this substantially is start taxing global emissions, a carbon tax. Now, this bill goes part of the way on that by taxing foreigners who try to import things that use carbon for the production process. But they miss the big part of it, which is taxing emissions in the U.S. And so the climate change parts of the bill, there's lots of incentives to, likely to be lots of incentives on electrifying cars and public transport and things like that.
Professor, unfortunately, I have to cut you off. We are out of time. I'm sorry, but this discussion was so insightful, and we appreciate the analysis from both of you. Devin and Mark, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
You've just heard a number of media reports from various sources that I hope will put the infrastructure bills into perspective. Keeping in mind that lifting people from poverty reduces the need for a social safety net, and using that net to do the lifting regularizes and normalizes the paradigm of public spending for public benefit, shifting the focus on corporate accountability and military spending and federal subsidies for various for-profit industries when it comes to the question of revenue is a good thing, in my view, but we should also remember that higher wages also mean more tax revenue, even when the tax rates on the lowest income and the middle class strata are not increased at all. We always need to weigh the social cost of poverty and infrastructure decline against the economic pains of correcting income disparity. Sometimes the solution to one problem is also the solution to another. It's a principle that applies in agriculture with regard to conservation. More labor-intensive and sustainable practices lead to less erosion and higher yields. In healthcare, the more preventative maintenance leads to reduced health crisis costs, and thus resources are freed to address the more urgent needs, while overall expenses are reduced. But of course, to get any of this done, public support will be needed. just like this station, needs your support. Please give what you can to your community radio station that you're listening to now. That's WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. The show is Conscious Voices. See you again next week for another edition. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.